Hello, everybody, and welcome to our presentation on Able United. I'm Katie Lear, the convention chair. Before we get started and turn you over to John so he can tell us how to save all of our money, I would like to thank our host this afternoon, Travis Butler, and John's going to do his presentation. When he's ready for questions, he will ask. And John Finch, it's all yours, sir.
Well, thank you, Katie, so much. I am so honored and glad to be here today to talk to you all about Florida's ABLE program called ABLE United. As mentioned, my name is John Finch. I am the director of this great program run by the state of Florida. I came on about 7 years ago and was there when we launched this program for the state. Prior to that, I spent about 10 years at the ARC of Florida, which is a statewide advocacy organization for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so I'm trying to broaden my wings here and my horizons to look at different kinds of groups and of individuals that we're currently not reaching with this account. And so through my presentation, I'll probably stop throughout to give you all an opportunity to ask questions, voice concerns, or if you want to throw stuff at me, whatever you choose. All right, so let's talk about Florida's ABLE program. So ABLE, just like any good disability program, has an acronym, right? So ABLE stands for Achieving a Better Life Experience. And it's based on a piece of federal legislation that passed all the way back in 2014. But its history is actually longer than that. It actually started in early 2000 when a group of parents were sitting at a dining room table and started discussing their children, primarily children with Down syndrome, and said, why isn't there a way for me to start putting money aside to help them save for their future without negatively impacting their eligibility for public benefit programs like Medicaid and SSI? So through hard work and advocacy, this piece of legislation finally came to fruition. Here in the state of Florida, we passed our own laws to house it under the Florida Prepaid College Board back in 2015, and ABLE United launched in 2016. But what was amazing was when the legislation passed, it broadened the types of individuals who this account could benefit. And so they really based the eligibility requirements back on the Social Security definition of disability, but regardless of age. So our mission statement here at ABLE United is to encourage individuals to save with their family and friends with after-tax dollars to help support health, independence, and quality of life. So by voice, how many of you have heard of a Roth IRA? Yeah, I hear a lot of people saying yes. How about a checking or savings account, right? Oh, yeah. Has anybody heard of a special needs trust? Yeah. Okay, a little less. Well, what's unique is it kind of, the ABLE account itself kind of rolls all three of these different products into one unique savings and investment vehicle specifically designed and actually advocated for from the disability community. As I mentioned, each state has to pass their own state legislation primarily to say, how as we, the state, going to set this program up? I'm with Florida, so the state of Florida, they said, okay, we're gonna launch this and we're actually gonna house it under the Florida Prepaid College Board. So Florida Prepaid College Savings Account, voice, anybody heard of that program? So that program here in the state helps individuals save for higher education expenses. ABLE accounts are Section 529A, which is modeled after the 529 IRS section, which is where prepaid college and savings accounts exist, so they said that makes sense. However, the College Board had no inkling of idea about the variety of disability groups and communities out there, and so that's when I came on board to assist with that. So that's kind of the history of how this program got established, it got set up. Now we're going to talk more about eligibility. But any questions so far on just the history of ABLE or any generic, broad questions about the ABLE program. Yes, front row.
Is that
miss?
Me?
Yes, that is you, miss.
Okay, you'll need a microphone or John will need to repeat to the people on Zoom.
Yeah, I'll repeat the question if that's fine.
Okay.
Wonderful. And what was your name again, miss?
My name is Shirley.
Shirley had a great question about eligibility, which is the next section. She wanted to know specifically, is there an age limit? Can you be, to put this in frank terms, too old to have an ABLE account? And that's a good question, and we're going to talk about that now. Unless there was another question. Was there a question on Zoom? Nope. All right, so let's talk about eligibility. What's unique is the eligibility requirements are mandated by the federal government under the Treasury, right? So this is an IRS-sanctioned account. The Treasury provides regulations to the states on how they're supposed to set these up. And so the IRS code has two that all states have to follow, and then an optional eligibility requirement that's up to each state. And so the two requirements is that the individual has to have a disability or diagnosis with onset prior to age 26. So that means the diagnosis had to occur prior to age 26. Doesn't matter your age now. So in our program, we have individuals, I think the oldest individual in our program is 86, and my youngest one is 3 months old. And so I serve a breadth of individuals who have an ABLE account because their diagnosis either occurred at birth, maybe it happened at 22, and what's unique is that actual age is being adjusted up to 46 in the year 2026. So that's going to open it up to many individuals, maybe some of you here today, that their disability diagnosis occurred at 30 or 35 or even 40. So we're going to be serving a much more broader set of individuals. So that's the first requirement. The next requirement is that the severity of the disability. So if an individual is currently receiving supplemental security income, Social Security disability insurance, they would automatically meet that severity requirement, because what the Treasury did was they pointed back to the Social Security regulations on who's eligible for disability type related Social Security benefits, but regardless of age, which is kind of unique. The one interesting thing is, of all the disabilities, blindness is very much defined in Social Security. Some of you could probably quote this better than I, but I'm going to read you what the Social Security considers as meeting their requirement. It says, we consider you to be blind if your vision can't be corrected to better than 20 over 200 in your better eye. We also consider you blind if your visual field is 20 degrees or less in your better eye for a period that is lasted or is expected to last at least 12 months. So I'm not a physician, so maybe you all can define and tell me what that means, but I don't know what that means. But if you meet that requirement, regardless if you're on government benefits or not, you qualify. And that type of qualification we call is self-certifying. So you would self-certify that, yes, I meet the definition of under Social Security. Yes, that it was diagnosed prior to age 26 and is expected to last at least 12 months. So those two requirements are true for all ABLE programs across the country. As I mentioned, each state sets these up. To date, I think 46 of the 50 states have set up programs. Washington, D.C. has also set up a program. We're all a little bit different in terms of the investment and saving options we have to offer, fee structure, and then who our back-end record keeper system that we use. But outside of that, there's a lot of similarities. The one other unique requirement that each state can determine is who they're going to open the account for. So here in Florida, we're only open to Florida residents at the time they apply. So that's a unique ABLE United requirement. Most states, well, I would say half the states, are open for nationwide enrollment. So, for example, I mentioned Ohio. Ohio runs about 12 other states ABLE programs, and they're a national-wide program. So if you were in Indiana, you could have the ABLE account that's housed or hosted by Ohio. But Texas, for example, Florida, and there's quite a few others. The other half are only open for the residents in their state. So that's the eligibility requirement. And as I mentioned, what's unique, it's a very broad set of disabilities. So my background personally is in developmental and intellectual, and we've done a great job in reaching out to, you know, individuals with autism, diagnosed with autism, or spina bifida, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome. So those all qualify as well as many psychiatric disorders. And now I'm here talking to you because this is a group that we need to just educate that these accounts exist. So that is high level the eligibility requirements for an ABLE account. I'm going to pause here to see if there's any eligibility questions about ABLE accounts. Yes, sir, in the front row. That is you, sir. Yes, that's you. So his question is, just like many other types of disabilities, it's progressive. So his question was, his blindness now in the last several years has been, he said 14 years ago, I think, he said you've been diagnosed as legally blind, correct? Is that what you said? But he said his diagnosis, though, originally occurred probably in your early 20s. So what's unique is that the diagnosis is one part, and the severity is the other part. So as long as you have that diagnosis, even though you didn't meet the severity requirement yet, you still would qualify because your diagnosis occurred at a younger age, before 26, although it didn't progress to the severity level until you were older. So your situation, you would still qualify, but you're qualified based now because you had that diagnosis earlier, but now you also meet the severity requirement. So his specific question was in regards to diabetes. He was diagnosed as a child. And so, unfortunately, I don't think the Social Security Administration recognizes diabetes as a disability severity that they would cover. So if it was just diabetes, potentially, most likely, no. However, the blindness
testing
and visual impairment would qualify. So there was a question, sir. I was asked to read your shirt, sir. It says, service human, caution, may bite. So he is a service human. He even has a dog collar on, so I don't know if that's part of the setup there. Pink leash to go with it. There you go. Oh, well, okay. All right. Yes, sir.
Have you got any idea what the rationale was behind the 26-year-old age limit?
Good. His question was the rationale about 26. So, honestly, truthful. So when this legislation was moving through, and a lot of times when federal legislation gets pushed, they say, what is this going to cost? So the Congressional Budget Office put a price tag of ABLE with no age limit at $10 billion over the next 10 years. So $1 billion more a year it was going to cost the federal government because individuals would now be able to access Medicaid or Supplemental Security Income, therefore increasing that or increasing the longevity they would rely on that. So federally, they had to say, okay, well, how do we lower that amount? Let's come to a point. So they just threw the hypothetical 26. I think they were kind of looking at the Affordable Health Care at the time that had the age limit of 26 for children. So hypothetically, it was like, let's just tag that on there. It stuck enough to where it got passed. Since then, we've been able to say, hey, look, this worry, this idea of like hundreds and thousands of people were going to enroll in ABLE accounts when it launched didn't come to fruition. So what happened was they said, okay, we'll take that into consideration. And now it's been adjusted to 46 starting in a couple of years. So that's how it happened federally. You know, things happen and they say, we got to save money. But that it was just a number on the wall. All right. So that's eligibility. Now we're going to discuss how this program actually works. How do you enroll? How does the process take place? All the ABLE programs across the country, not just Florida's ABLE program, is done online. Take that back. So Maine, the state of Maine, the only way you can open an ABLE account in the state of Maine is you have to go into a local bank. They partnered with the bank to offer these. So outside of Maine, everybody else, the process is an online enrollment. So our website, ableunited.com, is the place you would go to register for the account, sign into your account, manage your account. But I'll talk high level the process. So when you go to open an account the first time, just like you were opening up a bank account or an investment product, we're going to need to identify who you are. So name, address, social security number, date of birth. What's unique is that this program can be managed by somebody else, and we'll talk about who that could be here shortly. But if somebody else is going to manage this account, so maybe a spouse or a sibling, or even if you had a power of attorney that could establish this account, they can manage it on your behalf. Since this is an investment savings account, we do ask that you contribute a minimum of $25 to get started. And that can be done through a connected bank account, or you can send in a check. During that process of contributing to your account for the first time, so that initial $25, you'll have to determine where you want to put that money. So not knowing how to open this program and explain to people what this program is, we start with very few options. So we have three pre-designed portfolio options that are risk-based portfolio options. So conservative, moderate, and growth. We also have five individual funds to choose from. Those five individual funds include an FDIC option. It's a high-level savings, high-yield savings account, interest type of account, a money market account, a U.S. stock and a U.S. bond that's managed by Vanguard, and an international stock option that's managed by BlackRock. So the conservative, moderate, and growth are made up of some of those options just in different percentage levels. So, for example, conservative is highly more into the bonds, while the growth is more into the stock options. And those are all tied to broad-based mutual fund type products. So it's not like you're buying just Coca-Cola or Petco or whatever places you might invest in. So that's important to know. So who can open and manage this account is unique, because we know not everybody wants to manage their own account. Maybe they choose not to, or they just don't have the capacity. As I mentioned, it's a hierarchy of individuals who can open and establish this account. And that includes, as I mentioned, a sibling, a spouse, a parent, a grandparent, if somebody was setting this up for a grandchild. It could even be a representative payee under Social Security Administration. So if somebody has on SSI or SSDI and has a rep payee, that rep payee can establish their account. And of course, the beneficiary can manage the account on their own if they choose to. So we're talking about contributions into the account. Who can contribute? How much can you contribute? The good news is anybody can contribute to an ABLE account. I used to joke that I had a friend, and every year for his birthday, he would send me a link to his online gifting page to contribute to his ABLE account. And I said, your ABLE account is almost as much as my retirement account. I think you should contribute to my retirement account. That's a joke, people. But anybody, so businesses, nonprofits, individuals can put their own money in, family, friends can help out, but it is limited to $17,000 annually from all sources. So, for example, let's say they had a special needs trust that put in $15,000. Well, that individual can only put $2,000 more in for that calendar year. So that's going to reset. And that amount's based on the state gift tax that gets raised every couple of years. There is an opportunity if individuals want to roll over leftover college savings plan funds, they could do that. What's important to know when it comes to contributions, though, is that ABLE accounts shelter assets and resources. And we'll talk more about, I have a section on public benefits we'll get to, But if you put earned income into an ABLE account, that still counts as earned income for income purposes. So that's important to know. When an individual, after an account is set up, there is the ability to launch a gifting page. So this makes it easier if you have other individuals that want to contribute to your account, and they can do it online. Additionally, if somebody is working and not saving for retirement, they can contribute above that $17,000 limit up to $13,590 or the lesser of their income. So there's situations where maybe family members are like, hey, we'll hit your $17,000, and if you're working, you can contribute above that if you're not saving for retirement somewhere else. All right, so the money's in the account. It's been growing. You've saved it. You invested it. A hurricane comes, and now you need to take money out to move across the state. Or if another situation where, you know, you want to go on a cruise. So how do you use the funds, and what can the funds that you've been saving for be used for? So there's multiple ways to get money out of the ABLE account. It can be withdrawn and back to a connected bank account. So if you're contributing from a bank account, you can actually withdraw back to that connected bank account. You can request a check, either online or call customer service, and they'll send you or a third party a check. And we also have an optional ABLE Visa prepaid card. This is a reloadable prepaid card that you can put a set amount of money onto it, and then anywhere Visa is accepted, you could use that card. Some things to know, though, earnings are tax-free if the withdrawals are used for qualified disability expenses. So what are qualified disability expenses? Glad you asked. So the Treasury gave us 13 broad categories. They say qualified disability expenses are expenses that relate to the individual with a disability and help improve, maintain their health for education, housing, transportation, legal fees, financial management, employment training and support, assistive technology and personal support services, oversight and monitoring, even funeral and burial. So very broad. They almost didn't, you know, each state kind of wrote a letter back to them saying it would be easier if you tell us what not to spend the money on. And so holistically, you probably can't give funds away, right? So if you have an ABLE account and you're like, well, I'm going to buy everybody, including John, a present for Christmas, you can't use your ABLE funds because it's not benefiting you personally somehow. You can't probably use the funds in the account to buy anything that's going to be harmful. So maybe alcohol, probably tobacco, definitely gambling. The only thing they told us was don't gamble your ABLE funds away. Unless you win big, then hey, that's another whole issue. And so when I think of qualified disability expenses, really it comes down to how does it benefit the individual and does it help improve or maintain their health, independence, or quality of life? So I've heard of stories of people modifying their home to be more accessible, saving to go on a cruise. I've heard of people putting down payments on homes or using it for ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft. So pretty broad and what you can use it for. Important things to know, though, once you make a withdrawal from your ABLE account, it does create tax forms. So what will happen is you will receive a 1099 QA. What that does is what tells the state, or we're telling the state of Florida is telling the IRS, this individual has an ABLE account. They made a withdrawal. Of that withdrawal for the whole year, how much of it was earnings? Now, those earnings are tax-free as long as you keep, you know, documentation on why there were qualified disability expenses. However, if there's an issue where you had no qualified disability expenses, which would be kind of hard to not come up with because it includes basic living expenses like food. So, but if there was a situation, maybe you just gave all the money away, you would have to pay taxes on the earnings portion plus a 10% penalty. So we should tell individuals, keep documentation in case the IRS asks. When we get to the public benefits and talk about SSI, there's a little bit more rules that applies to you. So that is one other thing I forgot to mention on this section was an individual can only have one ABLE account nationwide. So unlike other types of investment or savings accounts where you might have multiple checking accounts, you can only have one ABLE account. So that's important to know. I'll cover costs, and then I'll open it for any questions about how the account works, how you can use it, or even setting it up. So everybody wants to know, this sounds too good to be true. Well, guess what? It is. No, I'm just kidding. It is. Each program in the country, when they set up their program, they have to say, okay, how are we going to offset the cost? Luckily in Florida, the Florida legislature gives us an appropriation each year to make this as free as possible to Floridians. So generally, we don't have any fees associated with our program. There's no monthly maintenance fees. There's no application fee. There's not even a paper check request fee. We do charge investment administration fees to help offset those costs, and those range between 0 to 0.29% annualized of the account balance. So, for example, let's say you had $10,000 in the account throughout the year, and you were in the most aggressive products, you would end up paying about $29 a year. But that's net of fees, so when you see your returns on the account, that's going to be net of this administration fee. Also, if you want paper statements, those are $250 per month, but you can always get them online for free. And then also that ABLE Visa prepaid card does cost $2.50 per month. We truly want to make this the best value for Floridians. Now, each state is different. There's some states that charge up to $60 a year to have this account, and then their investment fees may be varied as well. So that section is on how the account works, how you get it set up, who can manage it, and then what you can actually use the funds for. Are there any questions as it relates to that? Man, I'm doing either a really good job or this is the first session after lunch. I can't tell. Ms. Shirley, front row.
What would be the benefit of an ABLE Visa versus any other type of Visa card that I have? Why would I want that?
So a question about the Visa card. So the Visa card is just an option if you want easier access to your ABLE account funds. It's a reloadable card, so you would have to preload it anyway. So for me, the reason we offer it is for that flexibility, but it might be individuals who are like, maybe they can't handle their money, and it's for somebody that needs some of that assistance. So they're like, here's this card. It only has $100 on it, so you can't go and spend all the money. However, a lot of people, what they do is they just make a transfer back to their bank account or request a check. So only about 8% of the people that currently have an ABLE account with our program actually use the prepaid card. Most everybody else is doing check request or contributing back to their bank account. No, it's not like a credit card or it's not like a regular debit card. I think the reason we did that is we didn't want somebody to have, if they had a child, for example, and they turned 18, that child got a hold of that debit card and goes, well, I bought myself a car. You don't want that. So, but any other questions in regards to expenses, setting it up? Oh, we got right a there. Question here in the front row. One moment, he's bringing the mic.
Oh yes, when you transfer money back to, let's say, your bank, what sort of fees or penalties, if any, are applied?
So transferring, any time you withdraw, there's no fees. We're not gonna charge you, we're not gonna ask you what you're gonna use those ABLE account funds for. The only time there would be a fee is if you want us to do a wire, which we usually don't recommend, or if you wanted like an overnighted check, then we would charge you $10 for that. So, but if you're looking for just a regular ACH transfer back to your connected bank account, regular snail mail check, there's no fees for that.
And Then my second part of the question is, being under 65 versus 65 or older, is there any tax or any type of difference in terms of the ABLE account?
To my knowledge, no, but there might be a financial advisor who could probably give you specifics. I know when we talk about the public benefits, the biggest concern individuals have is what happens to the funds in the account if they pass away, or if the beneficiary passes away. So, but to my knowledge, I don't know, unless there's a financial advisor here in the office, I wouldn't know if it makes a difference between your age.
Okay, thank you. And then one more question just hit me. I've got a 34-year-old daughter, and she's the only one I would want to leave anything to. So based on that, if she were on the account with me as managing my account, would that help her at all in terms of accessing the money when I pass away, or what are the rules regarding what you've got to have when you pass away to get the money to somebody, the beneficiary?
Yep. Great, and we're actually going to talk about that a little bit in our next section. So specifically on what happens to the funds in these accounts when the owner of the account passes away. Good question. So we'll dig into that. But any other questions about that before we move on to public benefits? All right, we have a question in the back row.
Hi, so I came a little tardy to the party, and I was trying to play catch up by looking online, but I'm a little confused. So I do have a retirement plan through my school. I don't know if you would recommend or advise, or if you're even allowed to recommend or advise that I move that over to an ABLE United, because I'm 28, I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You mentioned some other things about withdrawing the money to go towards other things, and it goes, I'm trying to play catch up in my brain too. You mentioned withdrawing the money, and it goes, like people have used it for like down payments on houses, and you'd have to justify that as like a living expense. So how would you, for an example like that, justify that?
Okay, so two questions. I'll tackle the first one first. Unfortunately, I'm not a financial advisor and cannot provide you advice. What I can tell you is ABLE is not a retirement account per se. So our section where we're found out in the Internal Revenue Code, which describes what a retirement account is, a 401k, a 403b, all those pensions, annuities, that's in a different section of the IRS code. We're our own unique thing. That's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So, for example, if you wanted to transfer over a retirement account to an ABLE, you couldn't do that without liquidating that, paying fees and penalties, for whatever that is. So that might not be in your best interest. The second part is keeping receipts and records on why it is a qualified disability expense. So we're not going to ask, but if the IRS were to audit you, or if you're on supplemental security income, which we'll talk about, they may request receipts. And as long as it's primarily for you, or you benefit from it, and it's under one of those 13 broad categories, then it's allowable. So we usually tell individuals, keep receipts, because IRS can go back about 7 years or so. So once again, the state of Florida, we're not tracking where you're spending the money, but we always recommend just keep those records. So housing, you know, living, paying for food, all that, it's pretty broad. I mean, most attorneys that I've talked to said, you know, it's hard not to justify just about any expense, right? Except for those ones I mentioned.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So let's talk about...
any questions on Zoom?
Yeah, any other questions? Questions on Zoom?
None on Zoom.
All right. Well, we'll talk about public benefits and tackle a little bit about what happens to these funds when a beneficiary, who's also the owner of the account, passes away. So first we'll tackle Medicaid. So Medicaid is a federal state program, helps pay very robust set of medical costs, usually is restricted to individuals with certain income limits and resource limits. So when I say resources, it's how much money, cash you have access to. There's also home and community-based waivers, which probably is not applicable to this group, but I know in a lot of my other presentations it is. So generally the funds in the ABLE account, and even taken out of the ABLE account, are disregarded when determining resource eligibility for Medicaid. Now, what happens though is funds in the ABLE account, they're not subject to Medicaid recovery. So if an example is a first party special needs trust, so that's a trust where it's set up, the person that's on Medicaid had a bunch of money either through a lawsuit, they received an unplanned inheritance, they won the lottery, but they still need to maintain Medicaid, so they go to a first party special needs trust so they can maintain their Medicaid. But what happens is if they pass, the state takes all that money in there to help pay back their Medicaid cost. Florida's different. So ABLE accounts are not subject for Medicaid recovery. They can't file a claim on an ABLE account. However, if somebody was on Medicaid, not Medicare, but Medicaid, any leftover funds in the ABLE account, first they're expensed for all those outstanding qualified expenses, including funeral and burial, then those leftover funds would go to their estate. Now, there is something called estate Medicaid recovery. There's some rules on it, the biggest one being that the individual has to be 55 or older. So your question previously was, you know, you're a little bit older, your daughter has access to your account, she's running the account, you pass away, what happens to the funds in those accounts? Well, first, she could use it to pay any of your outstanding bills. So if you had mortgage that needed to be paid off, outstanding bill, funeral and burial costs, at that point, any leftover funds would go to your estate, and then it would go through the estate process, which may be probated, which may go through legal processing to get those funds distributed. So there may be some fees associated with that. So it's something to think about, especially as you do a planning. So always recommend talking to an attorney about your unique needs and how an ABLE account could play into your estate planning. So that's Medicaid and high level, the process if an individual passes away. The other big program that we see roughly a third of the individuals we serve have is supplemental security income. So Social Security has two different types of programs. One is a program you pay into on your taxes, retirement. So that's what one set of funds is. The other is a supplemental security income. So this is a monthly check that helps pay for basic living events, basic living expenses like food and shelter. And there's certain requirements to meet that. So SSI has a little more rules because ABLE accounts, remember, they shelter how much, shelter is a resource, so how much money you have access to. SSI says you can't have more than $2,000. An ABLE account allows you to have more than that, but there are some rules. So Social Security wants to know if you're on SSI, if you have an ABLE account, how much you have in there, because if it's above $100,000, it counts as a resource. And then if you're using it for housing and non-qualified expenses past the month you took the money out. So I always encourage individuals, it's if you're on SSI and have ABLE, let's sit down and talk. It's a little more detailed. They have an online, what they call their program operation manual system. So it's a little more complex if you're on SSI, but it's still very doable. Like I said, a third of the people we serve have SSI. The big benefit is, you know, saving more, having more than $2,000, and then also that money can be used to pay for a variety of expenses without impacting their SSI. So that's high-level public benefits, how the account works if an individual passes away. One thing I didn't mention, which may or may not be applicable, is that You can designate a successor owner beneficiary of the account, but it has to be a sibling who also qualifies for an ABLE account. So that might not be applicable for your unique situation. So you can have a successor designated owner on the account because the individual with a disability, they benefit from this account, so we call them the beneficiary, but they're also the owner. And so you can have somebody that can be a successor designated owner of this account as long as they are a sibling who also qualifies for ABLE. It's very convoluted. The federal, when the final regs came out from the Treasury, they actually, I think it made it a little more convoluted than clearing matters up. But that's just something to think about. If you do have a sibling who qualifies, you could list them. And then in those situations, the monies would just transfer over to them instead of going through the estate. Any questions on public benefits or general ABLE questions? And because I'm about to wrap up. Any questions on Zoom? Sherry, we have a question up here in the front row from my friend Sherry here, all the way from Ohio, everybody. She drove down here, came here, you know, just for me. I feel so. And then she says, can you help me open an account in a different state? And I'm like, what? Okay. Just kidding.
Okay, I guess I need the last thing clarified a little bit. In terms of, I'm so sorry, on passing away or whatever, I can designate a sibling. Does that person have to have a disability, or can this just be?
Okay, they would also have to meet the ABLE qualifications.
So if I don't have anybody like that, what happens to that money? I can't just. It can't just become like part of my will or whatever and go to my husband?
Potentially, yeah. It could be part of your will. You would it would have to go to your estate. And so,
I see.
Since it's you're the name, yours would be the only name on the account, depending, you know, talking to your attorney, seeing what the legal ramifications are that. Will it have to go through probate? Could it be a probatable asset since it's only tied to your name? There's a lot of legal questions that...
So yeah. I can't just designate it going to, that I want it to go to my husband or to a sibling or whatever?
Unfortunately, no.
Wow. Okay.
So that's something, as mentioned, something to think about when you're setting up this account, what the goal is. Is it to shelter resources so you can be on Medicaid SSI? Is it to have it as an emergency backup fund that earns a little bit? Or do you really want to make this an investment tool for the long haul where you're looking to say 20, 30 years down the road, I'll take money out. Because these accounts can actually go up to $418,000 before you can no longer contribute to them. So that's a significant amount of money. And do you want it all in your ABLE account? That's a question best asked for a legal counsel or a financial advisor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. All right. If there's any other questions, another question up front up here. My friend, I got to get your name, sir.
My name?
Yes, sir.
Derek.
Yes.
Derek
and Sherry. All right. My two friends.
Just a quick one. Could you give us a clarification of the definition of special needs trust and how that might differ or impact something like this?
Okay. So a special needs trust is a It's a financial tool that's set up by attorneys to allow individuals with disabilities to either receive money or if they have significant amount of money. The main goal of those is to shelter funds in order for individuals to maintain their eligibility for Medicaid or SSI. So I'm not an attorney. This is educational information only. Don't sue me. I'm with the state. So that's what special needs trusts are for. You're setting it up in order for you to get Medicaid or maintain Medicaid or SSI. Two primary special needs trusts. There's a first party where the individual themselves with the disability, it's their money somehow. So they received $1 million inheritance. They won the lottery. They they filed a claim and won a huge lawsuit settlement. but they need to keep their Medicaid because it provides such a robust set of services that we need a first-party special needs trust. There's also a third-party special needs trust where maybe you have a child that has a significant disability and you want to be able to leave stuff for them, or you have grandparents that want to leave something for them and you don't want to negatively impact their future, especially when it comes to Medicaid or SSI. Those are what they call third-party special needs trust. There's a lot of rules and regulations between those, and so that's why it requires an attorney to set up because they're very unique. But one benefit is that a special needs trust, those funds can actually fund somebody's ABLE account. So, for example, I work with several large trust companies across the state that have individuals that have ABLE accounts, and it's easier for them because those usually require a trustee to oversee the account. Instead of having to go, the trustee going all the time and asking for money, it's just easier if they deposit, you know, $17,000 in their ABLE account, and then that person can use that money as however they see fit. So that's special needs trust in a nutshell as it relates to ABLE accounts. But when you want to go down that road, you're going to have to go through an attorney to get finer details. Thank you, Derek. All right. So I have this section on here. I said we just need your help, right? Because this is a newer program. I'm an army of one. I do have a public relations team I work with, but usually it's me, and we have what we call brand ambassadors across the state that actually have ABLE accounts themselves, or they're a parent of a child that has an ABLE account. And so we just need your help. So if you have an ABLE account, or you know of a group of people that need to learn more about this, please let us know. If we could be a resource for you or your organization, if you have an email listserv and we can just get the word out that way. Any way we could just help tell others about this program is always appreciated. But if you need to get a hold of me, we do have customer service. Our number, Monday through Friday, 9 to 6. Our phone number is 888-524-ABLE or 888-524-2253. And you can also just send me an email. I have like 8 email addresses, but the easiest one is info@ableunited.com. And you can shoot me an email and ask me a bunch of questions, and I'll try my best to get back to you. But that is, unless there's any other questions, that's all I have. So I'll open the floor for any last-minute questions we have about ABLE accounts. Derek has another question. He's like, John, can you meet me after here to help me open my account? And the answer is yes, Derek, I can. But no, that's not his question. That was...
All your contact info, could that be found on the website?
So my direct information's not found on the website, but if you go to the Contact Us section, if you scroll down, there is a calendar where you can actually set up to have a meeting with me directly, and it will send you like a Zoom confirmation, and we'll talk over Zoom. So that's the best way to get me. Info@ableunited.com. Or if you call customer service, they usually are pretty good about getting back to me and saying, hey, so-and-so reached out and they want to talk to you. Hope that helps.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
And I'll help you set up your account after this, so no problem, Derek. Also, Derek reminded me, since he wants an account so bad, that all new accounts that open before the end of June, we're going to put $50 there in your account just for saying thank you. And so no risk, no obligation, but yeah, try it out. If you like it, that's great. If not, keep that $50. I don't care. It's your taxpayer money. Anyways. Oh, yeah. We have another question. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I was rambling.
Okay, John. Quick question for you. Now, where are you physically based?
I'm physically based in Tallahassee in one of the many state buildings.
Are you a state? So you're a state employee?
I'm 100% a state employee. Yes,
oh,
sir.
My sympathy, sir. But
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for paying your taxes. Yeah.
Okay, and I guess for the rest of the convention, you're going to be available in the exhibitor hall?
Yes, I'll be in the exhibitor hall today, tomorrow. I'm leaving Sunday morning, so Sunday breakfast, you know, if you want to open an account, I'll be here.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. All right. I don't hear any other questions. Well, thank you all. Hopefully it was enjoyable. You learned at least something. It's so honored to be here. And yes, that we do have a exhibit space. I'll be there right after here. I'm going straight there after this. But if you have any additional questions, feel free to stop by today, tomorrow, or buy me a drink. I'm just kidding. You can't buy me a drink. That's against state rules. But hey, I could buy you a drink, though. All right. Thank you all, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you, John. We appreciate your presentation very much, and I think there will be a line in the exhibit hall.
Yep. A line. You hear that? All right.
A line.
I appreciate it.